Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome back to the Reformed Dissenters. We are the show where Reformed Christians dissent against popular ideas of culture by asserting a biblical worldview. I am Bruce Johnson, joined of course by my brother Jacob Johnson.
Hello everybody.
And we have a very, very special guest today. We're joined by Dr. Joe Rigney. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And he wrote the book that we are reading this month, which is Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, Resisting the Anxiety That Will Wreck Your Family, Destroy Your Church, and Ruin the World. Really solid book. We read the introduction and chapter one last week, and now we're moving into the rest of the book for the rest of the month. So very exciting. And we wanted to have him on just to chat about it. We've kind of been able to get some exclusive reading done here in Moscow since it kind of hasn't gone out yet past Moscow. So it's been kind of nice to get a sneak peek. It'll be really neat to chat with him about that today. Before we get into all that, though, we have to do what we always do, which is talk about our verse of the week, our passage, our verse. Actually, it is a verse this week. Yay! We made it. It's not just like 12 verses strung together. It's 1 Chronicles chapter 29, verse 11. And this verse says, "Yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens and in the earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord, and you are exalted as head above all." And so this is one of those quintessential passages. We talk all the time about this post-millennial hope, but also just about cultural engagement. What does it mean to get involved in culture? What does it mean to go there for? What does it mean to Christianize or disciple a nation? What does that look like? And is that actually going to happen? Is that something that we can actually do? And passages like this inspire us to get to work, right? God has the greatness, the power, the glory, the victory, the majesty, and everything in the heavens and in the earth is his. So when we're talking about all these topics, we're talking about how to Christianize parts of society. We're not doing this with just our own strength. We're not doing this with our own power. We're not doing this under our own locomotion, if you will. We're doing this through the power of God, through his Holy Spirit, which we just celebrated with Pentecost Sunday, right? This past week. And it's because of this truth here that our Lord in heaven has all the greatness, all the power, all the glory, all the victory he needs to overcome everything in heaven and on earth for his glory and to transform this world for his glory. And so when we talk about these sorts of topics, like what we're going to talk about today, we are really addressing what does it look like to live like a Christian in your emotions, right? What does it look like to, all the different books we've talked about over the last 3 years are addressing how you are supposed to live and supposed to take dominion for Christ over every area of life. So this book, I think especially, reading through the introduction, reading through just the first chapter, it's already so powerful. And the first chapter leaves you with like this cliffhanger, like, oh, there's supposed to be, this ordered hierarchy in the world. There's meant to be these structures that are in place. But something's missing. Something's not right. They're not there. It's destabilized. Something's wrong. And ultimately, it's because of verses like this that we know the world will eventually become back in order. It will eventually be put back in order. And so that's what we're focusing on when we talk about things like this. So let's just get right into it. So Dr. Joe Rigney is a faculty at NSA, which I'm sure pretty much everybody listening to this show, if you haven't heard of NSA yet, I mean, New St. Andrews College, like, come on. But it's a really great classical Christian college trying to create culture shapers, which sounds great. Maybe you could tell us a bit more about that in a second. But then you're also, you've written this book. Have you written any other books as well?
Yeah, I've written about 6 books.
Wow.
Other ones. So,
oh, that's great.
Yep.
That's awesome. Yeah. What are some of the other?
Live Like a Narnian.
That's right. Yes, that was my first introduction. Yeah.
The Things of Earth and Strangely Bright, which is on loving God and treasuring God by enjoying his gifts, that kind of thing. I've got a book on Lewis on the Christian life. I've got a book called More Than a Battle on fighting pornography. And then this book and a book on courage.
Wow.
So how the gospel creates Christian fortitude.
That's great. Yeah. That's really neat. Have you written those largely to address things that you see popping up, or what's been your motivation whenever you're like, hey, I need to write a book about this? What's that?
Yeah. Narnian was like, I wrote that. I'd been teaching a class, and it was 2013 when it was the 50th year anniversary of Lewis's death. So there's big, Desiring God had a big conference. And so I wrote that book kind of for that conference. And then Things of Earth and Strangely Bright were sort of extensions of Christian hedonism. So I was obviously in Bethlehem for a long time, and Piper has been hugely influential for me. And that was kind of an extension of that into how do you wrestle with the tension between loving God and the world around us. Let's see, More Than a Battle. Yeah, I came out of counseling, you know, men and college students for years on how to deal with pornography. And then Courage, I was Lewis and the Christian Life. Because I wrote Live Like a Narnian, Crossway approached me about doing Lewis on the Christian Life in their series. They have theologians on the Christian Life. And so they asked me to do Lewis. And then someone else approached me about doing Courage. It was a series on virtues. So I think there's four of them: humility, unity. There's one other one, and then Courage. And so they asked me to do the Courage one. So
yeah,
that's really neat. Some of them I got asked to. Some of them were just came more from my own interests.
Yeah, yeah. So do you see? I suppose then I should probably ask about the motivation for this book. Have you seen this as the one of the core issues, because I know there's a lot of issues in our modern world, right? Like there's a lot of things that are popping up, and a nation under judgment or several nations under judgment, like God, I mean, that manifests itself in a lot of different ways. When God darkens the minds of people in a nation, they go crazy with it, right? So has this been one of the core things that you've seen as like, hey, we need to get emotions figured out before everything else, or what's been your motivation there?
Yeah. So I've been teaching sort of Friedman stuff for a decade or more in classes and talking it and that sort of stuff. And so this was basically Canon Press, when I got out here, said, hey, we'd love to do something on Friedman. We know you love him. Doug's a big fan. This is kind of a thing we need a way to make this accessible. And so they kind of approached and said, this would be a good project for the moment, and not realizing kind of just how timely it was, I suppose. I know there's certain places that are like, I wish you'd have written this like 5 years ago, because it would have been really helpful. And I was like, yeah, sorry about that. I was doing other stuff.
Preoccupied.
So that was kind of the impetus. It was let's do it for the moment, try to keep it brief, accessible, something that would be, not a big heavy tome, but just something that would be punchy and practical. And so that's what we did. And so far the reception has been pretty good. Like folks are definitely, I've had a number of people go like, it feels like you're reading our mail. You're spying on our text threads.
Wow. That's what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Would you
say they're okay. So if someone's reading your book, if you want them to take like one thing out of your book, what would you say would be that one thing that you want them to come away knowing fully?
Yeah. So I think it would be the way that emotional dynamics between people really do shape and mold the culture of an institution, whatever institute, home, church, business, nation. That's kind of underneath it, and that the fundamental sort of the fundamental virtue, I kind of use it as an organizing virtue, because you can use it to get to a bunch of different places, is sober-mindedness, which is not being drunk on your passions or the passions of other people. So passions are powerful. Passions will run the show if you don't watch it. And healthy, godly societies, institutions, have to have sober-minded leaders in order to stabilize them, so that they can endure the external trials. So external trials are going to happen. That's baked into the cake. We live in a fallen world. Sober-minded leaders lead through that. They don't get wrecked by it. Institutions that don't have that kind of leadership fall apart, crumble, whenever stuff happens. So I'd say that's at some level kind of that's at the theoretical level. Probably the most practical thing at some level is like the most immediately applicable thing is learning to pay attention to your own hesitations, reluctances, passions, you know, basically there's a kind of self-knowledge, divinely guided self-knowledge of when you're being reactive, when you're flinching at something, when you're frustrated at something. That's a sort of fundamental characteristic. You can't, because otherwise leaders just, stuff happens and then they feed it back into the system. So somebody else is reacting, is upset, is anxious, whatever, and then that hits you. And if you're not careful, you're just going to amplify it and send it back in more powerful. And so learning to recognize, when am I sort of getting out of sorts? When am I losing my cool? When am I losing sober-mindedness? So that then I can step back and go, okay, get a grip, get grounded, trust God, you know, so get grounded in the truth. And then now I can actually enter back in and help and not just be one more emotional domino that falls over in this anxiety storm.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. That's a really good point. It's a good way of putting it. Yeah. So, you mentioned Friedman, and he's this, I think you introduced him in the first chapter. And I'd actually had never heard of him before. So this has been a really interesting learning experience, like learning about this guy. You were talking about how he's a Jewish psychologist, right? Or psychiatrist.
Yeah. Therapist. Yeah. He was a Jewish family therapist who died in the 90s. Wrote a book called Failure of Nerve, which has been it's an influential leadership book, basically. But that has kind of predictable flaws and some wonky bits to it. It was published after his death. His kids kind of pulled together he was in the middle of writing it. He died. His kids pulled together his notes and tried to package it. And so what they came up with is really good, all things considered. It's a great book. But it suffers from some defects in various ways. And I think a lot of times Christian leaders will read it, find it really helpful, but it's a hard book to give to people because there's it's a thoroughly evolutionary framework. Lots of evolutionary biology to explain concepts and so that's sort of like baked in. So for Christians, it's hard to kind of what am I supposed to do with that? And then he's got some kind of wonky theology that kind of pops up here and there. And then there's a lot of technical psychological terms that he uses. And so it's not a great book to just give to people. They have to be a certain level of maturity probably to really read and benefit from it. And so this was kind of one aim of the book was to kind of baptize, Christianize Friedman's thoughts on leadership, because he does have a lot of really great insights on just the way that people work and the way that systems work. And so it was to take his categories and then kind of more, you know, root them in more biblical soil so that people could benefit from them. Try to draw where do we see biblical examples of this? So for Christians to be able to read it and go, okay, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I remember that story in Acts, or I remember that incident in the Old Testament, and say, see the dynamic, see what's going on here. See how this actually works. Because there's a good chance that it's happening in your circle as well.
Yeah. Well, I thought that was great how in the first chapter you took his basic general framework, but then you tied in, you know, Genesis 3 and, you know, the process of falling into that, you know, how the fall happened and how it still fit within this framework, but it could be explained through this. And then you pulled it out even more and showed a practical example of like, hey, this is how emotional sabotage happens. You know, like it's so easy to fall into this. You don't even realize you're going through these, you know, these steps. Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, it's really cool.
Yeah. Could you, you had said earlier a little bit about the getting drunk on your passions. Could you expound on that a little bit more in like the practicalness of realizing that in your life?
Yeah. So passions are like our immediate kind of reactions to things. So they're not exactly choices. That's the word passion means that there's a sense in which we are passive. Now we're responsible for them. So we don't want to make ourselves so at their mercy that we're not responsible. The Bible teaches us that we're responsible for the passions, the passions of the flesh, which wage war against your soul. Don't submit to the passions of the body, that kind of thing. So there are these kind of like instinctive, intuitive, immediate impulses and reactions to reality. So if you like, so like when, you see something that's good, you immediately want it. Just kind of like a, just an immediate like gravitation. Or if you see something you don't like, there's an immediate recoil. Sometimes you'll have an object that you want, and then something gets in the way. There's an obstacle between you and it, and that makes you angry. Right. So that's the passion of anger is when you see a good thing. There's a thing you want and you can't get at it. That's anger. Or there's a thing that you want. Sometimes it's sadness. Which is in a similar vein. It's a passion that kind of has a comp. There's layers to like something I want and something I'm not getting. Fear. So there's something I want, but there's something that's preventing me from getting it, and it's not. It doesn't produce anger, but the it's a dangerous thing. It's a scary thing, and so I have passion of fear. So fear, pity, sadness, anger, desire. These are all passions.
Yeah.
And then you can kind of combine them in various ways. So like we all have those and they need to be governed, guided, stewarded. They need to submit. They need to be obedient to what our minds and our minds know to be good and what our will clings to. So they've got to be brought to heel, and frequently they're not. So when passions are running the show, right, we're gratifying our passions, indulging our passions, being led by our passions, being conformed to our passions. That's all kind of the biblical. Bible speaks in various places about that. Sometimes the word is desires, depending on your translation. Mm. But it's talking about that thing. And so when they're running the show, one way to speak of that is to say you're drunk on your passions, right? In the same way that alcohol clouds your vision, more impairs your judgment, affects your bodily constitution, impairs your spiritual, moral, intellectual capacities. Passions can do the same thing, right? So when anger is just rising up, you don't think clearly. Or when fear grips you, right? When fear falls upon you, you don't think clearly. You make stupid choices. When sexual desire has you by the throat, you can do things that you wouldn't do. So these are all passions. Friedman had this category that he used as sort of a core leadership category of self. He called it self-differentiation, which basically meant like kind of having boundaries. There's a me and a you, and I'm not going to bleed into you, and I'm not going to let you bleed into me in the wrong way. Like, we have boundaries. But it's a kind of hard comp, it's self-differentiated leader with a non-anxious presence. And it's like, that doesn't just like, if you think about it, you kind of go, okay, I think I know what's getting at. Well, the Bible term for that is just sober-mindedness. Mm. It means just the same way that you're not drunk on alcohol, you're not drunk on passions. They're not running the show. They're not leading you by the nose. And so learning to recognize when your passion, their passions are good. Like, that's how you stay alive. like the reason that you swerve whenever something jumps out in front is because your passions kick into gear and go, oh no. And they, trigger the body. So like passions are actually a good thing, but they have to be on a leash. Mm. And so learning to bring them to heel is a key fundamental part of maturity in general, but especially for leaders who are responsible for other people as well.
Yeah. It definitely sounds like it's a practice. It's something you need to learn how to hone and work at to get as a practice. Would you say that this is something, this is very much biblical wisdom. This is very much, every situation is going to be different, but you're working through it. Would you say this is something that previous generations maybe had their mind around a bit better than we do? And so this is something that they kind of knew, or is this, everybody needs this, or?
Yeah, I think there, so psychologically, I think that there's been a, I think, 19th and 20th century psychology didn't always help us on this kind of stuff, because either you had a flattening in one of two directions. So either things got flattened in kind of a spiritual direction where everything just got, you don't really think about the way that you have this kind of hierarchy of desires. Higher level powers and then these lower level passions. So most Christians didn't have that because it was all just I want something or I don't want something. Like, passions became flat. On the flip side, the secularists flatten everything into the body, and it's all brain stuff. It's all chemicals. It's all brain stuff. And so there was, I think, a psychological shift that I think was detrimental. The classical kind of Christian tradition has always kind of had notions of like just the virtues, right? What are virtues? And it's like, well, what courage is it's a, it's an overcoming of fear. Okay. So fear is present. The passion of fear is present, but it doesn't run you. You cling to a good, you pursue a higher good, and that overcomes the, the obstacle, overcomes the fear that you feel at the obstacle or the scary thing, the frightening thing, in pursuit of the greater good. And there's a, that, so that's courage. And you could think of other words. Compassion is this naturally, we feel, when we see something, somebody hurting, it's a normal human thing to identify with that. That's a normal, natural human. It's just part of being human. Well, compassion is when that spur moves you to do something, moves you to seek to alleviate the pain. So that's passion, but it's got to be on a leash. I got to know what's good for them, right? Not just get swept away by them, but what's good for them.
Yeah.
So older virtues, accounts of virtues would have all of this kind of stuff. And I just think in particular eras, the passions slip the leash and run amok. And we live in one of those times where it's just everything is amped up. Everything's dialed up. And that results in sabotage to leaders who attempt to bring some steadiness into institutions and try to be shock absorbers. Well, everybody, panics. Everybody, and so you get the attempts to steer you. You get attempts to kneecap you in response to faithfulness, because nobody wants to rock the boat. Everybody's afraid of the blow up.
Yep.
Yeah. So we have these, we're kind of talking about these passions and stuff in there being able to put either affect them with your will and being able to personally do that. How do we affect that? How do these passions affect other people when going out into the world? How do these emotions, how does this sabotage happen in the world?
Yeah. So a leader's first responsibility is to put himself in order. So there's a self-control, sober-mindedness. But then the way leaders function in institutions is they lead fundamentally by gravity. Okay. So, it's their gravity that sort of pulls others into an orbit and allows them to kind of keep in step. Sober-mindedness is one component, and maybe the biggest component, of having some, gravity, which allows other people to kind of fall in line. And oftentimes, you can recognize when a leader lacks gravity because he tries to compensate for it by yelling or something like that, right? Or manipulating. So when leaders are manipulating, or when leaders are blowing up, they're basically, it's a de facto recognition, I don't have any gravity here. I don't have any pull, and therefore I'm compensating for the absence of that by trying to raise my voice to make happen what I want to happen. And so that's a sign of failed leadership. That's actually weak leadership. Whereas godly leaders are sober-minded, steady, and they pull others into their orbit. So in the home, the husband, the father is sort of the anchor. He's the one, he's the head, and therefore his presence is what directs and guides and puts his own house in order. In a church, it's going to be the pastors. In a state, it's going to be magistrates. So each of these institutions will have representative leaders, heads, that kind of put the body in order by virtue of their gravity. But it's important to get that, like, the leader doesn't steer the emotional vehicles of his followers, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's not, because it won't work. You can't. And if you do it, you're introducing into your institution a habit, an emotional pattern of the way you get what you want is manipulation. And instead, you want to use gravity, persuasion. Sometimes you have to use disciplinary means. That's fine. Those are on the table. So you spank your kids or whatever. But by and large, like, those are means. Like, you know, I want to take this body. This is the mission that God gave this body. I'm the leader of this body. I need to take it there, and I need to do so by my gravity. And then I've got tools in my tool belt in order to shore it up, right? So I can use exhortations, or I can use just instruction and teaching, rebuking, correcting, praising, disciplining. All of these are different tools that a leader has in his tool belt in order to guide and lead his institution where God wants to take it.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. Yeah, one of the things that really struck me when you were first going through this, well, I mean, when I was first going through this book and, like, looking at it, was the fact that it's about controlling your emotions, but you immediately applied it to leadership, right? Like, leadership and emotional sabotage. It's not just, just here's how you can ethereally control your emotions and rein them in and just, you know, not applied, which I thought was really good because this is what men need. Men need this application of, okay, sure, I'm supposed to control my emotions, but, you know, but why? You know, what's the, where do I use this? How does this play, play out? So I thought that was really neat. Well, very cool. Are there any, you have any last five minute questions?
I do not. Thoughts? No.
Nice.
No.
Well, very cool. Well, if people wanted to grab this book, where can they get a copy?
Yeah. So, I think it's going to be back up on Amazon pretty soon. Otherwise, emotionalsabotage.com is kind of the way you can get it from Cannon. Cannon's got a little website that they put together and that has the book there. So emotionalsabotage.com.
That's great. Awesome. Well, thank you, Dr. Rigney, so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Really good conversation. And we're looking forward to hearing what you and the audience think of him on the show. So thank you.
Great. Thanks.
Very cool. Well, thank you all again. Don't forget, go to our show website, trdshow.net. Watch us censorship free because YouTube hates free speech and has kicked us off many times. So you're going to want to go to trdshow.net to watch all of our episodes for free. Thank you all very much. We'll see you next week. We're back to talk about, actually, we're not talking about current events next week because Jacob is flying home. So, but we will be breaking down the next couple chapters in Dr. Rigney's book on Friday of next week. So stay tuned for that. Otherwise, have a wonderful weekend. Have a wonderful Lord's Day. And remember, everyone, in all that you do, do it as unto the Lord.